Did was to recover that idea in the classical world. And you'll remember that in the classical world, we had, I'm sorry, they would have only been the gentlemen in the room. We had the men, and let us say, 7 out of the 10 men had to make earn a living. So we took them aside, and we gave them professional training on how to be a doctor or a lawyer or a gardener. But we had 3 people who were rather privileged, and these 3 people had wealthy parents. Now, as you know, if you've read Lord of the Flies, you shouldn't leave choir boys alone unsupervised. So what should we do? Well, these people are free from the need to earn a living. Therefore, they are liberal. They're free from that need. Therefore, we have the practical arts to train people in to do trades and professions. We will have the liberal arts for the free young men to discover not what it means to be a lawyer or a doctor or a candlestick maker. We're going to have them with this whole idea that since they're free, their end, what they'll discover is what it means to be human. So that in the Renaissance, when they rediscover these liberal arts that had existed in the classical world, it was that time when people could go aside and what they could do was to discover not what it was to make a living or to be a successful person in the world, but what it was to be a human being. So we had the practical arts and the liberal arts. And the people in the practical arts had a training. But the people in the liberal arts had an education. Educere in Latin means to lead out. If this half of the room were to be trained, a phenomenal amount of authority because I can show them what to do. But if we move to the liberal arts, the instructor, the teacher, Socrates, Marsilio Ficino, Castiglione, in the words of Aristotle, only becomes the midwife. Educere helps to lead out. And of course we come to both Plato and Wordsworth that learning may primarily be experienced in remembering. And notice that education, educere, where someone helps you to lead out your ideas, is very different than the training of giving ideas into someone about what they should do in order to perform. And this classical idea was discovered with the de' Medici supporting, Marsilio Ficino making the manuscripts available, so that what we had was gatherings of men and women in this conversazione that weren't concerned for a practical end, but were concerned for a theoretical end. Now I'm using those terms in our contemporary sense. Because Aristotle had said, and one of the key things about Ficino, I think, that is so important that I think many people don't emphasize enough, that he was not there to reject the Aristotelian world and put a Neoplatonic world in its place, but he was there to see the marriage of the new Platonic ideas with the Aristotelian ideas that had come. He was a man creating new wholes rather than trying to separate. You know, if we take the word diabolical, we were talking about this on this retreat in Spain. The word diabolical, in its etymological function, means to take things apart and separate, where the symbol takes things together and makes wholes. And one of the marvelous things that Ficino was able to do is to present this great Neoplatonic dialogue that occurred over the centuries, discovered new manuscripts in this tradition, made them available to people, and men and women, cleric and non-cleric, were able to sit down and to discuss. And they were reviving that idea, really, of Aristotle in terms of value. Because, you know, Aristotle said, the most valuable things are the least useful things. And the most useful things are the least valuable things. And let us say that Viv and I are friends. Aristotle would say, well, why? And I would say, well, she's a good cook. And I've been to her house for dinner. And Aristotle would say, wonderful. That's a friendship of utility. But if I said, you know, I like to be with Viv, well, why? Well, because of who she is. Not because of what she can do or what she can produce as an end in herself. Well, the marvelous thing here, of course, is that Aristotle would say, well, this is a friendship not of utility, but of the two persons. And one of the marvelous things that Ficino is going to do, he's going to talk about friendship, is the fact of people valuing each other not for what can be produced, but for who they are themselves. Now, am I going too fast or too slow, too dull, too... It's not going to be too interesting, I know that. I think one of the things that I find from reading Marsilio Ficino, first of all, is that when... And I think the letters are perhaps the most accessible, and I would recommend that as a good place to start, is that one enters into a conversation. And in this conversation, we start to discover that what we know ourselves is part of that conversation. And this was certainly the idea that they had in the Renaissance, that in the conversation, it was not only the classical work speaking to us, but us speaking back to the classical world. And the interesting thing that really hasn't come up so strongly, I think, in English literature until William Wordsworth, because Wordsworth, like Plato, started to look at recollection. And if you remember, how do we talk about or how do we anticipate... intimations of immortality based upon recollections of childhood? Now, if you think of this, and we have a dialogue also where Socrates takes a young boy, and the young boy has wisdom. And of course, the early Christians and the Christians of the Renaissance took this wonderful, because of that, remember that wonderful picture of Jesus teaching in the temple, and this whole idea of the wisdom of the child. And that whole idea of the importance of the memory. And Joseph Conrad, of course, said that the most valuable gift that any of us had was the gift of memory. Now, we talked about Ficino just at the beginning, and I would hope that I didn't say too much, that what you would like to do is to go out and read a lot more of him yourself, and maybe meet with some people who would like to talk about him. The difficulty is that this great revival is going to run into things like Savonarola. And good things don't happen forever. But what had started in Florence of the 15th century is then going to be taken up by Baldassare Castiglione in the first part of the 16th century at a place called Urbino. And what I hope to do in a few minutes, to visit both Florence and the de' Medici Chapel with you, and then to visit Urbino. Because Urbino becomes the place where this Neoplatonic dialogue initiated by Marsilio Ficino also comes to a flowering. And what happens is this beautiful little city of Urbino, oh, you might know the court painter there, his name was Raphael, and he had a son who did very well. Tremendous things happen in Urbino, and we'll listen to that for a moment. But what occurred was in the story that they had dinner, And after dinner, they went to this lovely room, one of the most beautiful palaces in the world. The Duke at the time was very ill, so he retired to his room, and his wife, the Duchess, presided over a conversazione about what is the ideal courtier. And remember, I was talking about, at this particular time, the court, the place for the exploration on seeing how the human and the divine come together. And they talked about the nature of the ideal courtier. And the very last, it's going to cover 4 nights after dinner, this long, wonderful Italian dinners and those long, wonderful Italian nights. And the 4th night, the last speaker is going to be Cardinal Bembo. And Cardinal Bembo is going to talk about the ascent, the Neoplatonic ascent of the soul to the divine, and how beauty plays an integral part of this. And then there's going to be a noise at the window. And they all walk over to see what it is, and they throw open the shutters. And they find it's the song of the birds, because they've been talking all night. And what happens in Urbino is an example of what Marsilio Ficino started out, that spread all the way across Europe at the time. And it's a way of seeing spirituality, the material life, how we live, how we serve the community, how we discover who we are as human beings in a conversazione with others, looking at this dialogue form that comes through the Neoplatonic. And there's a lovely book out, I don't know if you've seen it lately, about a little Urbino that occurred in the 16th century in England. I do sound like the... I'm sorry, the travel agency. It's just 5 miles from Salisbury, and it's a place called Wilton. And Wilton House, interestingly enough, was visited by the de Medicis. I've only found out several weeks ago. And they brought 8 Renaissance paintings. They were visited by the de Medicis in the mid-16th century. Unfortunately, we don't know what they... paintings are. But this whole idea that you have this rounded courtier who is not only a man of this world, but a man whose soul arises to the next, and that art and poetry is one of the way of lifting one's soul. What happens is that there's the Countess of Pembroke, and her brother is Philip Sidney, and he comes to Wilton House and says, this is just like Urbino. And what happens is he writes his poem, Arcadia. We're going to have William Shakespeare come to Wilton House, either perform, we don't know which one, Midsummer Night's Dream, or probably As You Like It. We're going to have Ben Jonson come. We're going to have a whole revival of the arts. We're going to have this conversazione and this idea of the Neoplatonic dialogue come through there. But I think that I've spoken quite a bit. It's time to look at something. And maybe, Julian, you might want to open a window. I suspect a lot of hot air has come into the room recently. If you'd like to see this all in how it happened, might I recommend that the best place to go is the Medici Palace in Florence. And in the Medici Palace, what they did was to commission a very small chapel, much smaller than the size of this room, that's going to be frescoed on 4 sides with one of the great periods that they were concerned with. That was the coming of the Magi, because there were processions all through Florence. There was a confraternity of the Magi. And I use this word confraternity, and it's very interesting, because we find that these Neoplatonic gatherings of conversation, these confraternities, are not people who are just concerned with themselves, but the idea of civic virtue comes, the idea of helping the poor of the city, the idea of the overflow out into the larger community is going to be a key part of this whole Neoplatonic conversazione that occurs. And it reminds me a little, do you remember H.G. Wells' mistress, was it? Rebecca West? Well, I think her best novel is wonderful. It's a statement, actually, about contemplation that she stole, well, she didn't steal, she borrowed, from Bernard of Clairvaux. The still fountain goes stagnant, the still pool goes stagnant, the fountain overflows. And this whole idea of the contemplative tradition, and obviously Ficino is going to be concerned with bringing the contemplative tradition back to the West, is one that goes out to the larger community. And the idea that what has been given to one then goes out to others. And so this confraternity of the three magi was one of the great celebrations that they had at the Feast of the Epiphany. And you'll recall that our Christmas in the West is a very Johnny-come-lately. The celebration of Christmas was that epiphany at the beginning with the coming of the wise men. And so what the de' Medicis did was to commission their small personal chapel with no windows to be frescoed on four sides. And as you know, the difficulty we have with crystal these days is that we have electric light, so we don't get the movement in crystal that the candles give us. In the same sense, they didn't worry about not having the natural light coming in. It was all lit by candlelight. Candles move. Therefore, all the golds, the colors in the frescoes would be alive when you went in to see and to pray there by candlelight. So we're going to see a visual representation, a product of this Neoplatonic revival that Marsilio Ficino was part of. And Julianne's the technician. She's practical.
It's coming, it's coming.
Have some of you been in this chapel? You have? Yes. Well, I hope this can awaken memories for you. Yes. Would you say about 10 people at a time could go? That would be about the number? Yeah. Ah, no. Well, that's fine. You're going very fast. We'll point out just a few things as we go along and kind of adjust ourselves. There have been, unfortunately, some additions, which means some subtractions, from the chapel. What I'd like to do is just to make a few comments that some people, some scholars have thought about representations of individuals in the particular thing. But what I'd like to point out, and we'll see it much more closely, is that in this Neoplatonic revival, and as it goes into painting, and of course we've got Raphael, who's going to be part of this whole circle, is that whether we're going to be looking at animals, whether we're going to be looking at human beings, whether we're going to be looking at nature in terms of rock or in terms of the flowers and the trees, we have a phenomenal revival of life. What we're going to be seeing, and if you don't mind, I'll just do a little pointing, is one of the magi here, another one of the magi here. We'll see close at hand, this is going to actually, this magi be Lorenzo de' Medici, we think, about the age of 11, and we're going to look at his grandfather and father also, but we'll see it up a little more closely. Now, if you're in that area, you will recall by San Lorenzo, the great de' Medici church where Michelangelo did his work, this very last villa on the right before the American speaking. The end of the block is the de' Medici Villa. And if you would go in through that great large archway in the center, you would go into the central courtyard, you'd turn to your right, you'd go up your stairs to your first floor, and we'll go into that chapel now. I use the word symbol in its larger sense, something that contains many, many, many meanings. It's interesting, there's another Renaissance cardinal at this time who had a lovely statement, "Oh God, you are a walled city who contains all contradictions within you." It was thought at this time that when one was looking at the three magi, when you were looking at the one of middle age, you were looking at the present. When you were looking at the old magi, you were looking at the past. And when you were looking at the young magi, you were looking at the future. Now, the interesting thing is that what we have is a magi to the far left, one of the three kings. You'll see him on that beautiful steed, the white horse there. The marvelous thing, of course, as you're here, what we're seeing is the coming of the Eastern Orthodox to Florence for that great Council of Florence, where Neoplatonic thought is going to be returned to the West, and we're going to have, for only 2 years, East and West come together. I really feel embarrassed. It does seem to me words are rather superfluous at this point. We do have Lorenzo, we think, as the young magi. He's here at the age of 11. We have his father, Pietro, and his grandfather, Cosimo, who began the dynasty. You obviously can spend a day here, just looking.
And all the birds would have very particular symbolism, psychological and spiritual.
The interesting thing about the magi of the Middle Ages, we think, was the emperor of the East from Constantinople. That's one interpretation. They have lately found a crown, and they think that this middle-aged magi, by the way, middle age is not a derogatory term in this context. Isn't that nice to know somewhere? That the middle-aged magi was the Emperor Sesimagund, I think, of Luxembourg, because they found a crown they think might be like that. If it's so, it would mean that the young magi, Lorenzo de' Medici, was riding between the Emperor of the West, Holy Roman Empire, and the Emperor of the East. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation is that we're seeing here the magi who represents the emperor from Constantinople. And Fra Angelico also did a painting along this line for the de' Medicis, and the artist here was trained under Fra Angelico. I'm certain they'd say Florence. Or the Jerusalem, the great mythical city. The eternal city. Yes, exactly. And you'll notice that in life now, everything is sacred. I'm reminded of a story. Michael Ramsay, when he was Archbishop of Canterbury, had the head of the Quakers to lunch at Lambeth Palace, and he wanted to talk to him about the nature of the Eucharist. And Michael Ramsay kept going on, and the Quaker didn't seem to be grasping it. And Michael Ramsay finally took his arm and said, "Don't you understand? The Eucharist is a sacred meal." And the Quaker said, "Oh, well, Your Grace, all meals are sacred to us." And one of the things that, at least from my reading of Marcello Ficino, this separation between the material and the spiritual, between the secular and the religious, between the divine and the human, is not really made. What we find is this great intermingling. And so we could call the whole thing sacred. Do you know what I mean? And he gives attention to every detail. And what we have at the far left is most probably the Archbishop of Constantinople, and we'll see him in a close-up. This is in fresco. I'm sorry, I made a mistake when I said the middle age Magnus could have been the he was the Eastern. There are two theories about this. This was either the Holy Roman Emperor or the Archbishop of Constantinople. Now the interesting thing about the Archbishop of Constantinople, he did die at the time of the council in Florence when Neoplatonic thought came into the West, and he is buried in Santa Maria Novella in Florence. And of course, humanity, in a sense, is seen at its fullness, it seems to me, in this world coming out of this Neoplatonic philosophy. Gozzi. Not only worked under Michelangelo, but I believe also worked under Gibretti, who did the gates, as you know, to the baptistry. And I think we're going to have a self-portrait of him in here. Thank you. This should be the Emperor of the East. Yes. Who had the vision. And at the British Museum, at the exhibit Sacred, it was his great signature that was at the agreement. Unfortunately, East and West only came together for 2 years. The youth, the future, Lorenzo. There is something else. The horse, I believe, is based upon an ancient bronze of a horse that they had found. And so there is a classical precedent for the horse that we have here. So we're seeing everything. We're seeing the ancient world, we're seeing the world of the de Medicis, and we're seeing the world of the Magi simultaneously. And to the far right here, we have one of the gifts, frankincense, myrrh, and gold. This is either myrrh or frankincense. Oh, yeah, the animals are phenomenal, and the birds. And this is a close-up of what we think to be Lorenzo. And notice that whole span of a person's life, the youth, the middle age, and the old age in the three Magi.
Was there a tulip painting at the same time as Birth of Venus?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we could go in if we had time, but you might want to discover you're in the future. Ficino is going to come across the manuscript where we're going to talk about, now see if I my pronunciation, God bless you, Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice great Magi. And if you'd like to know more about him, you can get some of his work. And you can also see his image when you walk into Siena Cathedral in the floor. And it was believed, of course, in this tradition that we're going to have one tradition coming through Hermes, through Pythagoras, eventually into Plato, with its parallel tradition coming through the Hebraic revelation into the Christian scriptures. And it's coming together of reason and revelation, the human and the divine. And I believe that this would be the originator, and that would be Cosimo de' Medici, and this would be Pietro de' Medici. And here we have the artist. I think he's the only one, isn't he, looking at us? And notice that every person is important. There's no individual who's not significant. Yes. Yes. I haven't seen anyone say that. Yes, yes.
Stern eyes, very patriarchal.
He certainly looks like he's from the East, doesn't he?
So this be the East and the West together.
Mm-hmm. This is primarily the people coming from the East. As the Magi came from the East to meet Christ, so also from Constantinople to Florence. Another self-portrait of the artist. And notice the animals with as much care as the human beings and the glorious costumes. And if you look at the young pages, each one, again, is an individual themselves. I believe, I'm not certain, but I believe that the page here would be carrying the gold. And notice there's the symbolism. There was a pseudo bead who gave the names that we often use now. Melchior, Caspar, and...
Balthasar.
Yes.
It's interesting.
Yes. Wherever you look, there's something to see.
What's amazing, it's a whole art of unity, of union, of coming together of the opposites, and all the recollections coming together of all the contradictions.
I'm afraid it's time to go to Urbino.